Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Lula has returned to the southern region of Brazil holding massive back-to-back campaign rallies with reinforced security. It was in this region that in 2018, Lula suffered an armed attack on his caravan, the same year he was imprisoned for 580 days in Curitiba. Workers' Party President Gleisi Hoffmann became emotional, reflecting back on the year when Lula was jailed in a move to bar his candidacy.
Esse é o seu retorno a Curitiba, Presidente Lula, no braço do povo.
This is your return to Curitiba, President Lula, in the arms of the people. It is redemption. It is the victory of our struggle over 580 days of injustice and over your persecution.
Polls show that the region continues to be a stronghold for Jair Bolsonaro. However, the incumbent faces fierce opposition, mainly as a result of what is perceived as Bolsonaro's failed policies.
O pior problema é que a fome voltou, né? Tem mais de 30 milhões de pessoas.
The worst problem is that hunger is back. You have more than 30 million people suffering from hunger. All the political and public advances that were made for the people are being taken away. People are not able to retire anymore. They want to starve people to death.
É importante porque o nosso país precisa reconstruir a sua...
Our country needs to rebuild its democracy, rebuild its nation, its unity, and its political democracy by respecting its diverse institutions. With the current government, our country became a worldwide mockery, a joke worldwide. It became a country disregarded by the main international political alliances.
Now, with just 2 weeks remaining, the slogan out here is Lula in just one round. Camila Escalante in Curitiba.
Syria's Ministry of Information organized an event to pay tribute to journalists who were killed while covering the war on the country. Syrian officials attending the ceremony praised the sacrifices of those journalists, who included reporters, cameramen, technicians, and other workers in the media sector.
The martyrs of media are the true heroes on battlefields alongside the Syrian Arab army. They will remain alive in our memory. Meeting their families is a great honor because they represent truly an example of strength and loyalty to the homeland. We are honoring them today to thank them for their great sacrifices.
Families and relatives received certificates of appreciation expressing to Press TV how proud they are that their family members' blood was one of the main reasons for Syria's victory over terrorism.
This event means a lot to me. When I receive a call on an honoring, I feel that my son is still remembered and even still around. This homeland requires us to sacrifice. Without sacrifice, we would have no future.
My son was a war correspondent. He was martyred near Kenitra. He was my only son. He sacrificed his blood for the country. The enemy and its media outlets were strong and working to weaken Syria, but thanks to the sacrifices of Syrians, we triumphed.
Press TV's correspondent Maya Nasser was also among the list of journalists who lost their lives during the Syrian conflict. He was killed by terrorists in 2012 while covering an attack on the Ministry of Defense in the Syrian capital. He is one of many journalists who was keen on always being on front lines to deliver the truth and perform his duty. Despite knowing the dangers of reporting on battlefields, many journalists risked their lives to report on the truth of events. Tens were killed or injured, defending the principles of journalism and showing responsibility in conveying what was truly happening on the ground in the face of a ferocious mainstream media campaign to distort the reality. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
The 77th United Nations General Assembly has opened, with the UN Secretary General warning of a winter of discontent as many Western nations are economically reeling from the backfiring of their sanctions on Russia. Iranian President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi will give his first address to the UN on September 21st. with a focus on creating a more just world through economic multilateralism. Raisi met with French President Emmanuel Macron and top leaders of the European Union, but amid what Iranian delegates described as a very tense atmosphere. France and the other Western signatories have failed for years to adhere to the 2015 Landmark Agreement, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Raisi told Macron that Europe needs to show that its foreign policies are guided by the sovereign interests of their citizens and actually separate from the demands of Washington. This week, Raisi will hold bilateral meetings with the heads of Iraq, Pakistan, Japan, and more than a half dozen other nations, as well as with representatives of a large Iranian-American community, a group estimated to be well over 2 million people. Raisi stressed that Iran is willing to reach a, quote, fair and stable agreement to revive the 2015 deal, but that Iran needs to receive reassuring guarantees that the U.S. will not withdraw from the accord, as it did in May 2018. Ramin Mazahiri, New York City.
Free pigeons for a world free of war. Iran's War University hosted the director of the United Nations Information Center in Iran, Inger Marie Veniz, along with military attachés from different embassies, to attend this ceremony dubbed the Book of Peace and Defense, which is themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War. The UNIC head read out a statement from United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the event.
A time to observe 24 hours of non-violence and ceasefire. We renew our call for all people to do more than lay down their weapons.
This event comes on the occasion of the National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, the longest armed conflict of the 20th century, which was waged by the then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and heavily funded by the West. Every year on the occasion, the Islamic Republic holds nationwide ceremonies to highlight its resistance against the Iraqi forces.
At that time, the Ba'athist regime, and on top of it, Saddam Hussein, was fully supported by numerous Western countries. The war continued for 8 years, but we fought the invaders and did not give an inch of our soil to them. So today, we as veterans feel bound to transfer our expertise and tactics to the new generation to preserve our defense might.
Saddam Hussein failed to make any achievement in his war against Iran, but the humanitarian effects of the offensive are still lingering in Iran, with many war veterans continuing to reel from exposure to chemical substances used by Iraqi forces. Those chemical materials were reportedly supplied by a number of German, French, and Dutch corporations.
The Islamic Republic takes great pride in how it defended the country during the Iraqi-imposed war, calling it the sacred defense and a drive for its present self-sufficiency in the military sector. Meanwhile, Tehran holds this annual commemoration ceremony as a chance to promote peace and shed light on the dark consequences of war. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Amid international calls for renewing the UN brokered truce, the Yemeni Center for Human Rights has held a press conference in Sana'a to release a report titled The Alleged Truce. The report highlights the Saudi-led coalition's violations of the UN agreement since it was brokered in April.
Saudi Arabia's violations were committed from the first day of the war, but they continued even under the UN truce. The most important violations were the non-compliance with the terms of the truce, which included reducing the number of scheduled flights and specifying only one destination instead of two, as well as the continued detention of fuel ships. There is a breach on the essence of the agreement.
The report says the Saudi-led coalition has committed over 14,000 violations, including waging 278 airstrikes, which led to the death of Yemeni civilians.
As a human rights center, we affirm that the most important violations are the loss of life. Unfortunately, during the truce, 70 Yemeni civilians, including women and children, were killed. The siege has also continued during the truce. This has caused the deaths of thousands of civilians due to the lack of fuel in hospitals.
Recently, the UN Security Council urged warring sites in Yemen to extend the truce, saying it has had tangible benefits for the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. So far, there are no signs of agreement from both parties.
A complete end to the war and siege is what Yemenis are demanding from the international community, including the United Nations. They say the temporary truce should not be extended since the world body has failed to ensure its full implementation. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
British police have found themselves embroiled in another racism scandal, this time surrounding the killing of an unarmed black man in South London by armed officers on the 5th of September. Following an alleged police pursuit, 24-year-old Chris Carber was behind the wheel of a car hemmed in by two police vehicles in a narrow street before one round was fired, ending his life. He leaves behind a fiancée and an unborn child. No gun was found in the car.
Thousands of protesters have descended outside police headquarters in central London to vent their fury over what they say is gross injustice being carried out by the authorities against Chris and his family. Accusations are swirling around, some of which include that the police who stopped Chris on that fateful day may have known who was inside the car in the lead-up to the fatal shooting. This is, of course, all being investigated, but the protest organisers have made absolutely clear that they are going to refuse to back down until the demands of the family are met and justice be served.
Fighting back the tears, family members spoke of their ordeal after seeing the body for the first time since the killing. News of the shooting has caused uproar, especially in the black community. They feel this was just another example of a racist system out to harm them. Following the backlash, the officer responsible for the shooting has been suspended. An investigation is also underway, but the police watchdog warned it could take 9 months to reach a conclusion. The family expressed anger at the lengthy wait. However, the question of race playing a role will be examined as a factor, providing some small hope that the family's demands will be answered. Robert Carter, London.
Palestinian protesters took to the streets in the blockaded Gaza Strip following the Friday prayers to condemn Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied city of Al-Quds. Angry protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime, vowing to sacrifice their lives for the sake of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The protest comes following the desecration of the mosque by Israeli settlers backed by Israeli forces. The mosque is the third holiest site in Islam. Hamas resistance movement has warned the Israeli regime against violating the sanctity of Al-Quds.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is a red line that mustn't be crossed. We hold the Zionist entity fully responsible for any attack in Al-Quds. The enemy will only open the gates of hell on itself. The continuation of attacks on the sanctity of Al-Quds will backfire on the Zionist entity and its settlers.
Israeli settlers regularly storm Al-Aqsa Mosque, a provocative move that infuriates Palestinians. The attacks and desecration of the mosque compound increased during Jewish holidays.
We salute our people in Al-Quds and we say to them that Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza will not remain silent amid Israeli attacks on Al-Quds. We also call on all Palestinians and Muslims to mobilize to confront Israel's conspiracies against Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians have raised the alarm over Tel Aviv's plots to divide Al-Aqsa Mosque into Jewish and Muslim sections or sitting times for visits.
The Zionists have no right to be in Al-Aqsa Mosque because it's purely for Muslims since ancient times. They are trying to control Al-Aqsa Mosque, but all their attempts will be in vain.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vowed to step up their support for Al-Quds until the end of all the Israeli violations in the Holy City. Observers say the world has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds while turning a blind eye to Israeli violations against the oppressed people of Palestine for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
It
Iranians across the country have commemorated Arba'in, the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. People in the capital, Tehran, marked the occasion too by walking southward to the town of Frey. That was a symbolic walk by those who could not take part in the Arba'in march held in Iraq, where pilgrims from across the world marched toward the city of Karbala, which houses the holy shrine of Imam Hussein.
I'm so sad that I couldn't visit the holy shrine of Imam Hussein this year, but I took part in this walk in Tehran to play my part in preserving the legacy of Imam Hussein.
This is a march for all of the freedom seekers, no matter what their religion is. Imam Hussein sacrificed his life 14 centuries ago to save our religion, so this could be a lesson for all people to uphold righteousness, even if it comes at the cost of their lives.
Imam Hussein is the third Shia Imam and the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. The Shia Imam and his companions were killed by the tyrant of their time, Yazid, during the Battle of Karbala some 14 centuries ago. Every year, on the occasion of Arba'in, millions of pilgrims from different countries travel on foot to get to Imam Hussein's shrine. The march is meant to sympathize with the Imam on the pains he endured during the Battle of Karbala.
To us Muslims, participating in the Arba'in march in Karbala is more than a religious duty, but a passion for preserving Imam Hussein's ideology and promoting it among the new generation.
Imam Hussein and his companions were martyred after they refused to pay allegiance to Yazid, for they believed he did not practice Islam, as taught by the Prophet Muhammad.
As Imam Hussein said, he rose against Yazid to revive true Islam as introduced by the Prophet Muhammad, who was Imam Hussein's grandfather. By his refusal to pay allegiance to Yazid, our Imam exposed the fact that Yazid was not treading the path of Islam.
This year, from Iran alone, some 3.5 million people took part in the Arba'in walk in Iraq, in a show of respect for Imam Hussein, who is known among Muslims as a symbol of resistance against tyranny. To Muslims, the Arba'in walk is of key importance. These people couldn't make it to Karbala this year, but they felt bound to take part in this symbolic march, for they believe by doing this, they would help preserve the legacy of Imam Hussein. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Like the other parts of the Muslim world, Pakistan Shia Muslims observe Arba'in with traditional reverence and solemnity. Thousands of mourners march in streets of Pakistan to pay tribute to Imam Hussein, the grandson of Holy Prophet Muhammad, who embraced martyrdom in Karbala in southern Iraq some 1400 years ago. The battle was fought between the faithful followers of the third Shia Imam, Hussein bin Ali, and Yazidi forces on the plains outside the modern Iraqi city of Karbala, which is home to Imam's shrine, a sacred sanctuary for Shia Muslims.
We believe the legacy of Imam Hussein is a timeless source of lessons about humanity and loyalty that exceeded his time and place. The love for Imam is endless and will continue until the end of this world.
The Islamic New Year, started from the month of Muharram, has been observed all over Pakistan with great dedication. Muharram is the month of mourning for the lovers and faithful followers of Imam Hussein.
We're here to pay tribute to Imam Hussein, his family and his companions who sacrificed their lives to save Islam. The mission of Imam Hussein is the mission of truth, peace and justice.
Similar mourning processions and religious gatherings were held in all major cities and towns all across Pakistan with special security arrangements.
The mourners and religious scholars have highlighted the teachings of Imam Hussein and his uprising against Yazid in Karbala. They regard the tragedy of Karbala as the symbol of resistance against oppressors. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
This one lay. This one lay. This one lay. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has spoken at the 77th UN General Assembly in New York. His speech was directed at the promotion of peace and justice. In the same breath, he slammed countries that promoted this notion, yet in action did the opposite, like the U.S. and its warmongering policies. In this edition of the program, we will look at some of the points that Iran's president has made and why Iran spoke from a position of strength compared to the U.S. when it comes to making a world a better place and a more peaceful place to live in. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Marseille. Also joining us is Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Simon Mohsen Abbas, let me first start with you. Obviously, there's many things that Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said during his address at the UNGA, which was his first time there, making the statements in the speech that he made. Let's talk about how he said that Iran was not seeking an atomic weapon. He made sure that something that was known before, that it got highlighted again, and that it was a fatwa coming from Imam Khamenei, and demanded U.S. guarantees that it would abide by any JCPOA sanctions removal deal. Why do you think he repeated that and deemed that to be important to highlight in his speech?
Because the Islamic Republic of Iran has some principles, and unlike the kind of immoral politics that we're used to across the globe, we tend to find that politics is a dirty word, fundamentally, because nobody says what they mean. And the Americans, of course, have demonstrated that within the JCPOA. The Europeans have demonstrated their ill will in that regard during the negotiations with Iran also. But the Islamic Republic of Iran has stuck very solidly to what it said, even though nobody else was abiding by the JCPOA. And the Americans walked out without even a flinch. Unilaterally. Nonetheless, Iran tried its best for at least a year, if not more, to comply with what was an agreement which effectively had already been made redundant. And since then, it's been a huge amount of patience shown on the part of the Iranian negotiators, the Iranian establishment, to try and keep this JCPOA scenario alive. In reality, you could very strongly argue that the Islamic Republic of Iran doesn't need the JCPOA. They've done quite well, thank you very much, through resistance economy, through a greater direction towards the east, the rise of the Eurasian axis, the increasing kind of look away from the west. Particularly with this establishment, what you're finding is even less traction than the previous one, where there was a possibility that they were leaning towards the west and overcompensating, trying to really win over the hearts and minds of the Western powers. The truth of the matter is The Western powers want one thing from Iran. They want the absolute annihilation, destruction, and termination of the Islamic Republic's establishment. They don't want the existence of this establishment, unless, of course, tomorrow Ayatollah Khamenei comes along, bends his knee, bows to the neoliberalists and the neocons and the Anglo-American Zionist empire, does everything that Israel wants them to do, hands over the wealth of Iran, and resubjugates its people to the greater money mafias of the world. You know, unless Iran really wants to do that, unless the Iranian public wants that, unless the Iranian establishment wants that, I'm afraid what the alternative is a sort of ongoing enmity and an ongoing guarantee that the West will do its level best to try and destroy Iran.
Elijah Magnier, there were so many things that I could have started out this program with, but I chose that one. And let me see if you agree with me, because I wanted to make an analogy with how Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi talked about the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program, saying that you have 2% of the world's nuclear activity taking place in Iran, but yet you have 35% of all inspections, ratio-wise, taking place on Iran's civilian nuclear program. And then you compare that with the way that Joe Biden came out when he first started his speech, where he said, we have to defend Ukraine, we got to stand up for them, which all translates into this military conflict, a prolonging. Is that a correct analogy to make in the way that Iran is promoting peace through the statements that we saw, where that notion and justice was peppered or was sprayed in the Iranian president's statement as opposed to what Joe Biden was saying?
Well, indeed, it is correct. There is also more I could add to it, is in the last 43 years, Iran never declared war on any country, while the Americans declared war in Afghanistan, on Iraq, on Syria, on Lebanon, on Yemen, and supporting the Saudis in the war in Yemen. So we see that there is no similarity between what Iran is offering to the neighbors and what the Americans are offering to the world. The Americans are only talking now and very busy with their war against Russia and very preoccupied with gathering all the Western forces in country, particularly the EU, behind it, not concerned really what's happening to to its allies, because they are the ones suffering. And Iran is saying, I'm ready to abide by the JCPOA if you offer the deal, even if you offer enough guarantees. While the Americans are talking from a position they are out of the JCPOA, they only offering wars, they offering weapons to Ukraine, they pushing the Europeans to offer more weapons. Nobody here in Europe has any more weapons in their warehouses. So any real war, they are in real trouble. And the Americans are producing more weapons just to send to Ukraine, because it is a Western war against Russia. So they need Iran at the moment, because Iran is their only hope, particularly when President Vladimir Putin announced that he is calling upon a part of reservists and he is willing to continue the war. Now, what the Europeans are going to do without the Russian oil that they are going to start imposing sanction on the 5th of December? Of course, they have Iran, they have Venezuela, and with both countries, there are sanctions imposed by the U.S. and particularly by the U.S., and nobody else dares to make business with Iran, particularly the EU, who did not, as your guest rightly said, abide by the agreement of the JCPOA and did not do any step to respect their deal and their part of the deal. So what we have today is a country that the U.S. is leading the world, but is leading the world toward more wars and more destructions. And Iran is saying, I can help you, but give me the enough insurance to return to the JCPOA, but I'm still in, but I will abide by it if you show the real intention that you are trustworthy. And sure, there is no point in Iran talking at the UN General Assembly, because a quarter of the world there are pro-US, and the two-thirds of the world is really not against the U.S., but not with the U.S., and preferring to stay either on the side or on the side of Iran.
Right. Well, I'm wondering how those people reacted, Hussein Mohsen Abbas, and how maybe you reacted also, Hussein Mohsen Abbas, when we heard Ebrahim Raisi speaking, and he was speaking about some of the issues that we're going to hopefully get to in this program, like unilateralism and the way that the U.S. has gained political leverage through controlling institutions over other countries. And then all of a sudden, when he starts talking about martyred General Qasem Soleimani and brings up a placard of him at the podium there at the UN General Assembly for the world to see, that it was the U.S. that assassinated this general that was at the forefront of eradicating terrorists from the region and even beyond. What impression did you get from that? And what do you think people thought, that this was the U.S. that did it? And here you have Ebrahim Raisi raising that point.
Well, I think it's interesting that Sayyid Raisi went for the humanitarian card. I mean, it's usually a weapon that often the West tries to use against Iran by inventing all sorts of bloated arguments about how despotic Iran is. I mean, of course, that's what's pumped out by most of the Western media, Western propaganda. Most Westerners haven't been to Iran for decades, if ever at all. So a lot of this propaganda can stick. But for Iran to take hold of that particular issue and to raise Haji Qasem Soleimani's placard is very significant, because what Iran is pointing to is that this region, as long as it has the American interference in the way they are prepared to interfere, you know, with their industrial military complex, with their sort of color revolutions, with their supporting of despotic, illegitimate leaders around the Gulf states, with their support of the Mossad and of Israel's Odin Yinon plan to expand across the whole of the Middle East, how on earth can you possibly have peace? The likes of Haji Qasem Soleimani, who were killed not even in action. He was killed as a diplomat traveling on the invitation of the Iraqi government, and the Americans didn't even respect that. What this shows is that the American regime has dropped so low that they actually don't really respect any international law. There is no rule of law that they really respect. So human rights violations, I think this is where Ebrahim Raisi was trying to hit, was that, look, do you really want a world where we have one bully, one unilateral bullying power that makes everybody do exactly what it wants. It was and it is okay to plunder, rape, pillage, destroy, kill, murder, maim, by their own admission. Don't forget, Mike Pompeo was very, very famously on air admitting that they steal, plunder, and do all sorts of other murderous acts, and they do it gleefully. And this is what the CIA's job is, etc. It's the job of the Mossad. It's the job of the MI6. So when you're faced with a force which knows no morality, which knows no real human rights, but touts democracy and human rights as its major reason for being in West Asia, exposing them with what they did to Qasem Soleimani is symbolic of what they've been doing against the Yemenis, against the Syrians, against the Libyans, the devastation, the ruin, the destruction they leave behind when they don't get their own way, and the theft of the gold and the oil and whatnot. Well, that's de rigueur. Whether they destroy a nation or not, they're going to steal those anyway. Mm-hmm. So I think the plea to the world, even though, as my colleague rightly pointed out, the plea to the world goes almost on deaf ears, because most of these nations are puppets or fear economic sanctions from America. And again, that terrorism of an economic kind, the psychological warfare terrorism that they engage in, the manipulation behind the scenes, these are all part of a war which Iran has been at the front line of against America ever since 1979. And now, of course, the Russians and all sorts of the Chinese as well, perhaps, are going to be gradually embroiled by the absolutely psychotic behavior of the Anglo-Zionist American empire.
So what I'm curious about, Elijah Magnier, is that when you sift through and dissect what Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has said, and then you try to look for things there that maybe are weak at any sense of the word in terms of what he's trying to present, and this is not to just compare Iran's President's statement to the U.S. statement, it seems like Iran and Raisi, on behalf of Iran, were speaking on a position of strength, because what he was saying was in essence a world that should be void of all these different injustices and negativity that's being pursued and then executed by the U.S. And he named some examples. Did you get that feeling at all in terms of the way that Iran has conducted itself vis-a-vis the U.S.?
I get this impression from the first day Raisi was nominated the president. So we've seen the Americans were playing a bit cool, thinking that Iran is going to rush to ask, please return to the JCPOA negotiation. We saw how Raisi waited for 5 months before starting the negotiation. That's one. Two, the Iranian negotiator refused to have the U.S. flag in the room where the negotiation was conducted with the Europeans on behalf of the Americans, and never accepted a direct meeting or direct negotiation with the Americans. The three, we see that today when Iran is saying, I want to prove that you're going to stay in the JCPOA, and you're not going just to sign the deal, and then after that you start imposing sanctions under different reasons that are really a way for the U.S. to reimpose more sanctions. So we see Iran, had Iran wanted to sign the JCPOA, it would have been signed months ago or even a year ago. But Iran is looking after the interest of the Iranian population by saying either we sign a good deal or no deal at all. But at the same time, Iran is sending a message to the world saying, even if I don't sign the deal and I am still in the JCPOA agreement, it doesn't mean that I'm going to go and make a bomb, although I have the knowledge to do it because I've reached 60%. I have all the advanced centrifuge of the 8th and 9th generation, and I can do it whenever I want. It's not up to you to decide if I do the bomb or not, because I will do it if I want to, but I don't want to. So this is the position of strength. At the United Nations, Raisi is talking from a position of strength, is aware what the world is going through, and in saying, I am not signing the deal, although the Iranian negotiator is here in the UN, ready to negotiate, but I'm not going to sign any deal. That is a position of strength.
Sure. Well, the U.S. has always tried to alienate Iran, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, and I believe through one of the statements that our guest there, Elijah Magnier, said before, that I recall, he said that Iran is going into this General Assembly from a position of strength, coming high off of the SCO summit that was held in Uzbekistan. And there, when you have Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi in the presence of world leaders speak and be present there, then you can't be isolated. Now, the thing is, and I'm curious about this, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, do you think that there are many countries who would like to take this stance against, not just against the U.S., but to push back against some of the U.S. ways and methods that it has used and speak up against it like Iran has done, but they're afraid to do that because they might be subject to U.S. focus, whether it's sanctions or foreign policy?
I think you're absolutely right. I think the overwhelming majority of nations in the world are deep down sick and tired of American bullying and threats. I mean, that's how they essentially operate their empire. They threaten people through, as I mentioned, color revolutions, economic threats, through military threat. They have done this for decades, of course, and now they're masters at it. But the time is running out, because what we're seeing increasingly now is the confidence of the likes of China and Russia and Iran, three of the major economic powers, now beginning to talk about moving away from the dollar. This never happened before. They're talking about creating new means of trading with each other, away from the SWIFT banking system. There's talk of opening up that $5 billion credit line which Russia wants to offer Iran. The Chinese are not worried about sanctions when they're doing deals with Iran, Iraq, and others, going into the multi-millions around building the Belt and Road Initiative. All of this basically is saying to the Americans, look, you can't have it all your own way. A multipolar world is a much better placed rather than the kind of dictatorial unipolar world that you've been dreaming of. And I think that that's where the world is heading. The Eurasian axis, I believe, is an inevitability. The Americans are making it an inevitability by really scoring own goal after own goal. They could have a softer policy towards Iran or Russia. They could share the cake. But the trouble is they've got so greedy and they've got had it so their own way for so long that they really are drunk on the using military means and other means and their other cunning tactics to see if they can coerce, scare and co-opt people into doing what they want. And all these other powers are saying, you can see China's policy. They tend to do fair deals. They don't go in and invade countries. They crack deals and they stick to those deals. They offer fair recompense in terms of building infrastructures of nations where they get resources. You could argue the wrongs and rights of that, but nonetheless, they're not imperialists in that formal sense of just raping and looting and installing leaders that they think will be conforming. So there's this rival power or a series of rival powers which are now coming up, and they will challenge America, and it will a world that will be in flux for a considerable time yet.
Sure. Well, this world order, that's a new world order, was expressed by the Iranian president, Elijah Magnier, in a few different ways. One of them was through denouncing unilateralism, in which Raisi said that American foreign policy, he said over the past century, had actually proven that the unilateralistic approach that the U.S. had actually pursued was at the self-interest and at the expense of partnerships. Do you think countries like, say, Mohsen Abbas said, don't speak up, but they really are sick and tired of it, and they perhaps are the ones that Raisi are talking about, that they feel that way?
I fully agree with Mohsen Abbas. What he said is really the truth, and this is the reality today. And we've seen that in the meeting during the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, where half of the world population representative and leaders were present to talk about the exchange with their goods and trade with local currency, and they were outside the U.S. orbit. Yes, indeed, the U.S. is challenged in its unilateralism. It's still strong. We should not think that the U.S. is not going to defend itself and is not going to cause more harm and to be more harsh than it is today, because it's going to defend its throne and its position worldwide. And to do that is going to cause more damage to the world, and it is causing it mainly to its allies in Europe and in Africa and other people who are in need of support, particularly in Afghanistan, confiscating $9 billion, etc. So, yes, the U.S. is going to defend its unilateralism, but it is challenged and is no longer going to hold for very long.
Last point that time allows us to make, say, Mohsen Abbas, I'm looking at the point that the U.S. President Joe Biden made on the use of veto power, where he said that countries should refrain from the use of this veto power. I'm wondering, when he says that, doesn't he realize then why does the U.S. use that veto power when it comes to Israel?
Well, the double standards are laughable, aren't they? This is what Aga Raisi talked about, the double standards of these Western powers. And they know it, but this, of course, they get away with murder because they can. And literally, by supporting Israel and doing what they did in terms of planting that kind of cuckoo in the nest in the Middle East, what they've done is they've perpetuated a war and a conflict which would never have been there. I mean, take Israel out of the equation there, and the odds are that you really wouldn't have the kind of turmoil and chaos and conflict. That's all created fundamentally and deliberately by the money mafias who wanted the oil and Israel to sit there as their policeman, and they continue to be hell-bent on doing that. Islamic Republic of Iran was the first to stand up genuinely in a real way. Yes, you had Jamal Abdel Nasser and all the previous wars that were kicked off, but in reality, the first constructive and really long-standing opposition to the tyranny of Zionism and Anglo-American Zionism has come from Iran. That makes it another target, and I don't think Iran is not going to let go that. They're going to demand justice for the oppressed, and not least of all for their own people in Iran.
Thank you so much, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator. Elijah Magnier, a pleasure, journalist and political analyst from Marseille. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Sacred Defense Week. September 22nd, the day in which the Iraqi imposed war on Iran started in 1980, has been designated as the start of the Sacred Defense Week in the Islamic Republic of Iran. A week which ends on 28th of September, please stay with us for a special program on the occasion of the Sacred Defense Week, from 22nd to 28th of September. On 22nd of September 1980, the Ba'athist regime of Iraq, headed by the dictator Saddam Hussein, started a fully-fledged war against the nascent and newly formed Islamic Republic of Iran. The Islamic Republic was just over a year old at the time, and the dictator Saddam declared war on Iran by appearing live on Iraqi national television and tearing up a copy of the 1975 Algiers Accord, a key peace agreement between Tehran and Baghdad. Thus, the eight-year Ba'athist military aggression against the Islamic Republic of Iran had started. Let us first of all take a look at the history of the 1975 Algiers Accord. On 6th of March 1975, Tehran and Baghdad took a crucial step to end several years of border disputes and border skirmishes, which had marred relations between the two countries. Even though the accord itself and all of its addenda and associated memoranda of understandings were signed in Baghdad, the accord came to be known as the Algiers Accord, since the president of Algeria at the time, Houari Boumediene, and other senior officials of Algeria had acted as mediators and conciliators. However, the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein tore up the agreement and attacked Iran on 22nd of September 1980, initiating a costly eight-year war. The war was imposed on Iran under circumstances where the arrogant powers, particularly the United States, had placed Tehran under a lot of pressure, and Iran's armed forces were still in disarray, still recovering from the unavoidable turmoil of the revolution. We'll be right back. Using Saddam and his army as their tool, the arrogant powers were hoping to wipe out the Islamic Republic. But the brave Iranian nation, with its absolute faith in Islam and unflinching determination, proved them wrong, scuppering all of their calculations and all of their plans, and leaving behind some formidable achievements, such as its unique culture of jihad and self-sacrifice and staunch resistance. Thus, as the Islamic Revolution triumphed under the leadership of Imam Khomeini, may his soul rest in peace, so it was that under his leadership, Islamic Iran triumphed in the eight-year imposed war. For the first time in the past 200 years, Iran had successfully resisted an invasion, driven back the invaders, had not lost even an inch of territory, and had achieved all of this without any help from the outside world. The late Imam Khomeini, may his soul rest in peace, had remarked, "We unveiled the true face of the colonialists and the arrogant powers during the imposed war. We recognize who were our friends and who were our enemies. During the war, we came to the conclusion that it was essential to stand on our own feet and not rely on others. And we shattered the image and the prestige of the two superpowers from the East and the West." The truth is, the 8 years of sacred defense brought with it some very valuable and lasting legacies for both Islamic Iran and the wider Islamic world. These legacies include growing self-confidence and self-belief, unwavering belief and faith in religion, the flourishing of Iran's talents and creativity, strengthening of national unity, more social cohesion, the growing authority and power of the Islamic Republic, Iran's cherished independence, becoming a role model for other nations to follow, and helping to awaken the Islamic world. The Islamic Republic of Iran has also been extremely successful in manufacturing a formidable range of military hardware, weapon systems, and ballistic missiles, giving the country considerable deterrence capabilities. Some of these ballistic missiles include the Shahab, the Fateh, the Qiyam, the Ahmad, the Sajil, the Khurramshahr, the Sful, Fateh Mubin, and Rad 500 ballistic missile. The military website 1945, in a well-known analysis, has concluded that the Islamic Republic of Iran has the most extensive, most effective, modern, and capable ballistic missile arsenal in the West Asia region, giving Iran a formidable deterrence capability and power. Commenting on the formation of a wide front consisting of both the East and the West against the Islamic Republic of Iran during the 8 years of imposed war, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "The main intent of this wide-ranging front was to create internal problems for the Islamic Republic of Iran, to weaken this country, and ultimately to destroy this country. But the great Iranian nation, despite all the difficulties and shortages at the time, successfully resisted this wide-ranging front and emerged with its head held high and with flying colours."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.